Welcome, everyone, to the Book and Film Globe podcast. I am your host, Neil Pollack, the greatest living American writer and the editor-in-chief of Book and Film Globe, www.bookandfilmglobe.com. We cover the worlds of books and film and streaming TV and much more. And usually on the show, we have a routine. We talk to a contributor or two or three about whatever books or films or streaming TV they've written about that week. But we're going to pivot a little bit this week. We're going to do something a bit different. We're going to have a special guest. And that special guest is going to take up an entire 27 to 37 minutes of time. I'm not exactly sure how long it's going to go.
I have 33 minutes worth of thoughts in me, so.
All right, well, that's about right. So that voice you're hearing is Richard Rushfield, who is a longtime colleague of mine and is the editor-in-chief of The Ankler. Richard, how would you describe The Ankler? And are you editor-in-chief or are you
First of all, I would describe me as the columnist for The Ankler, not the editor. Don't confuse me with someone who actually does anything here.
So. You're a writer for The Ankler, but you're one of the founders of The Ankler. Maybe you could describe to me what The Ankler is.
The Ankler is a subscription newsletter about the entertainment industry, largely for entertainment professionals or entertainment nerds who enjoy that sort of thing.
I guess that's why I wouldn't really consider myself an entertainment professional at this point, but I guess I would consider myself an entertainment nerd because I like the deep dives on the sort of comings and goings of executives and casting calls and box office numbers and the other things that you guys provide. There also are interviews with industry stalwarts and producers and other people working in other aspects of the industry. It's a really, The Ankler is a great publication and it's kind of filled this gap. I think there's been a gap in entertainment media for a while. You can't really trust sort of the traditional entertainment reporting sources, but it's also not like, I would say you're not a snarky Gawker style publication. It's definitely like business facing.
Yeah. We are about the community sort of for the community. So we're not here to burn it all down necessarily.
Yeah. You're boosters, but not boosterish. That's how I'd describe it. And Richard, we've been friends for a long time, so that's joyfully. That's neither here nor there. Although it will be there at a certain point in this interview. But I wanted to have you on this week because I wanted to talk about something that we seem to mention every week when we do the show, and we've even run a couple articles on this topic ourselves on Book and Film Globe, and that is the absolute collapse or near collapse of the box office, of the Hollywood box office. Every week, there's a new Planet of the Apes movie. It's not performing that well. The Fall Guy is not performing that well. And then when Furiosa, the Mad Max, the Fury Road sequel Mad Max thing came out, everybody in my circles, and admittedly I realize how limited my circles are, were very excited about this movie. And then that proceeded to underperform compared to even a movie about Garfield.
And what is Garfield to you? Is that doesn't count?
No, I mean it does. It does count.
Garfield isn't entertainment in your book?
Garfield has long been entertainment to me. But but you figure like movies that like are family facing, cartoons essentially, generally are going to do pretty well, especially in the summer, because there's a lot of bored parents with a lot of bored kids. So I'm not so surprised that the Garfield movie has not disappointed box office expectations. But, the sort of adult box office, it's just not, I mean, you would agree that it's not, it's stumbling around.
No, it's a catastrophic summer. And what's, to give it a shade of complexity to the picture that you just painted, the movies that you mentioned as doing badly are not necessarily doing badly for what they are. If you had Fall Guy has made $80 million domestic and I think $150 million worldwide and at this point. And if you had said, okay, we're going to do a comedy based on starring Ryan Gosling and Emily Blunt, both of whom are actors with great followings, but neither of whom are open huge pictures. Like they're not Dwayne Johnson. level. So we're going to do it. We're going to do a romantic comedy starring the two of them based on a TV show that nobody knows what it is. So what would you imagine that would finish at? I would say about 100 million probably. That would be a good result for that. And that's probably about where it's going to end up. The problem is that that these movies were all placed in the prime real estate of the sort of pre-Memorial Day window, where the expectation on movies opening then is that they do 2 to 3 times that amount. And why were they put there? Because that was the best that the studios had.
Right. Well, that's the real issue then, right? It's not that these movies that are really like mid-tier franchises, Planet of the Apes, Furiosa, King Kong and Godzilla Beneath the Planet of Godzilla, or whatever that thing was called.
Furiosa seems like a genuine miss.
It's kind of a whiff. I mean, and I saw it and I talked about it last week, and I just feel like it just doesn't. It just it was missing something. Both at it was a prequel to a movie that people really didn't want to see a prequel to. Regardless, so yeah, but it's still not like a total turkey. Like, it's not gonna, I mean, maybe it might not earn its money back, but it's not like, it's not like a critically panned film or anything. But I guess what you're saying is that where are the blockbusters? This is summer. What's going on? Where are they?
Where is your Fast and the Furious? Where is your Transformers that you have come to expect and rely upon in May, especially if you're the CFO or shareholder of a major studio?
Well, that's a question. You're the entertainment journalist. You tell me, where are they? What happened to these movies?
Well, the studios are blaming it. So there's the big problem is there's this pipeline that has fallen open this year. They're releasing many fewer films than they used to. The norm is considered about 120 wide, fully funded, fully marketed releases. So 3,000 screens or more with marketing budgets in the mid, how many figures is 10 million? Eight figures.
Yeah.
Or beyond. The ecosystem that's been created is dependent on having about 120 of those a year, and will be significantly short of that this year. And yeah, the studios are blaming the strike and saying, but that's like saying, the strike was something that they had a lot of influence over. So it's like saying, hey, I decided to go to the beach instead of doing my homework last night. So that's why I didn't do my homework. So what do you expect? Of course, right, there's no homework.
So just give me a passing grade and I'll do better next summer.
Yeah, I was at the beach. How am I going to do it at the beach?
Look, you and I are of a certain age, men of a certain age, who grew up. I spent my entire summer, every summer, at the movies. I mean, part of that's because I lived in Phoenix and it was 177 degrees outside and there was nowhere else to go other than the movies. But like, for instance, our chief film critic, Stephen Garrett, sent me this list of from the summer of 1982 alone. The Road Warrior, Blade Runner, E.T., Star Trek II, The Wrath of Khan, The Thing, Fast Times at Ridgemont High, Tron, Poltergeist, on and on and on. I mean, yeah, those are
any one of those would be the best movie of this year. Yeah,
the best box office movie of this year. And everyone's like, well, there's still Deadpool and Wolverine coming out. I'm like, okay, yes, there's Deadpool and Wolverine that will obviously do decent superhero box office business, but that's like at the end of July, and that just, you can't have like an R-rated superhero parody essentially like anchor your entire summer. That just, there's just, you're not gonna, and it's frustrating because I felt like last summer we were kind of back to it a little bit, and it seems to have fallen off again, and I wonder too, you've talked about this before, you've written about this before, I think in one of your newsletters. You still like going to the movies, right?
I do. I have young children still and a family who rarely allow me to do that. But in theory, it's an activity I would enjoy
if you had the opportunity. Whereas, no one on Earth, very few people on Earth go to the movies more than I do. I mean, I'm two, three, four times a week. I go to the Alamo Draft House or the Austin Film Society or occasionally some other screen as well. I famously, at least in my mind, even continued to go to the movies in 2020, almost every week. And I didn't even let the pandemic stop me from going to the movies. But I'm increasingly feeling, Richard, like I'm a dinosaur. And not even when I'm seeing dinosaur movies.
So you know what the average number of times an American goes to the movie a year is?
Between one and two, right?
1.4, yes. Is a number extremely close to zero.
Yeah. And, you know, when I tell people about my going to the movies, they're like, well, what are you seeing? There's nothing good to see. And I'm like, that's not true. There's all kinds of groups. There are good art films. There are movies where King Kong whips a little baby ape around his head and hits other King Kongs. There's
Garfield.
There is technically Garfield. There's Despicable Me 4, the Return of the Rise of Gru or whatever that's called. You know, there's a new
picture. There's Emma Stone becomes her own mother and has to grow up in her body.
Yeah, there's that. There is a Pixar movie. There are superhero movies. Yeah. There are movies where things explode. There are quiet movies. There's all kinds of movies being made. And many of them, if you live in like an even a medium-sized market, they still show up in theaters. So you can go to the movies. Saying there's nothing to see is not an excuse. I just think that it's just people are they're either out of the habit or they don't want to, or maybe it's also that movie theaters are just horrible to go to.
I think people don't like leaving their house anymore. Mm. I think we've anesthetized people in their home too much. And I think everyone has become sort of agoraphobic and like grossed out by people being in the same space as them. And, we spoke during the pandemic about the lockdown happy people who were like, you know, lockdown forever. This is how we should have been living all along. Why would you talk about ending this? This is we've figured it out finally.
Yeah, it is true. Like, you know, you and I have talked about this before. Other people in movie theaters are very annoying. They talk, they text, yeah. they chew, they sit near you.
But that's part of the. But you know, I've been blessed in life that I've had the opportunity to get a lot of people thrown out of movies and movie theaters. And that, you know, that's part of the joy of the experience that you get to.
I agree.
Can encounter those people and bring down some punishment to them. So I don't know why they can.
Here's a question. And this is a bit off topic. Does that drive your wife crazy when you do that? When you go to the, you know, because when I do that and I play cop in the theater, my wife is appalled. She wants to leave as well.
Appalled is within the range of reactions. My children, certainly the one time I dare do it in their presence, they have not forgiven me for that.
They'll understand someday. You're like a frontier lawman. You're administering justice.
You know, it's a thin blue line, and after me, it's just bedlam. It's people will be tearing off their heads and eating their brains for.
Yeah, putting, I agree. But regardless, like, I mean, I think we can all agree that the movie business is kind of a mess. And I just wonder if we could ever get back to that day where, I mean, those summers when you had movies like that list I read, and you could pick any summer from the 80s or the 90s or the aughts. Different genres, different movies, different actors. Going to the movies was what you did. So, all summer long.
So I've been doing the Ankler here for 7 or 8 years now. And every few times every year I put forward like an ideas to save movies issue, and I say, hey, how about if you have like a special Skunkworks division, or what if you all, how about doing more comedies, how about doing, and after 7 or 8 years of this, I've just given, they're not going to do any of that. Like, they're not going to try to take chances. They're not going to try to do something different. They're not going to do all the obvious things that everyone says they should be doing. Like, none of that is going to happen. And it's just the studios have just become too giant and bureaucratic and beholden to a financial world that doesn't really like the movie industry, and they'll never get out of their own way. But so, but change, when it comes, does not generally come from in the studio system. It comes from outside. And I have an inkling that there will be new companies coming up and new things happening, and they'll find new ways to make money. But I don't think it's going to be the studios are going to get it together.
Yeah, well, you know, no one was talking about Blumhouse or A24 particularly 10 years ago. And those are names that you reliably are creating all kinds of cinematic content. I also don't want to be a fogey and be like, wow, it's obviously like 1966 and the new wave of independent filmmakers is going to come along. But, you know, there could be something like that. The sort of the movie industry does regenerate every so often generationally.
Yeah. And it might look more like Lionsgate than yeah, like the 1970s. It might look more like, you know, a lot of Jason Statham films. But there's this huge room in there. I mean, the studios have stopped making comedies. I think there's maybe two comedies on the release lineups of all the studios this year. And, yeah, you know, I never saw the moment where America stood up and demanded that they stop being given comedies.
I would like them. I would personally like a lot of comedies. And I'm beyond the point of my career where I can actually make them myself. So,
yeah. And and there's a lot of money on the table. The studios seem incapable of realizing it anymore. And I think the ability for I won't get into it because it's very wonky and it will bore your listeners, but
more than they are already. Yeah, yeah.
If you're still with us, you have no one to blame but yourself. but it's means are coming by which people movies can be distributed more widely without a giant studio behind them.
All right. Well, I will. I'll take your word for that, and I hope it's true, because I know that like I would prefer to just spend the last, I don't know how many years I've got left, 20 to 35 years of my life.
Really? 35? You've got 35 left?
I could do it. I mean, I'm in good shape. I'm in such good shape that my I have a 21-year-old son. And he timed me today, and I held a forearm plank for 2.5 minutes, Richard. For 2.5 minutes.
Really?
Yes.
Really?
So I'm in good shape. So possibly. But regardless of how many years it is, I want to spend them at the movies. I like going to the movies. I will be the last senior discount member. They tear down the last movie theater. I'll be the last person in there.
I'm with you. I will be. If movies die, it will be a impoverishment of this world, or a sign that the world is not worth saving anymore.
I don't think they're going to die. I think I've been saying this about literature for a while. It's become something kind of specialized, like opera or ballet, or classical music, where there's, you know, millions of passionate fans, but it's not like the popular art form anymore. I just don't feel like I don't want to put movies in that category.
Yeah, you don't want to, but the thing about it is, say the movie audience gets cut in half. Say half of it goes away, which is very possible. It's like what it costs to run the overhead to run like even kind of the bare bones studio and marketing and distribution, like just to like kind of cover your nut on that is such a high place that I don't know if studios can survive that and stay in that business if half of it goes away. So then if, say, you don't have big studios in the business, and there's only five of them now, and they're negotiating for one of them to possibly be consolidated as we speak into another. So soon there may be only four. Like, once you start declining like that, you get into this death spiral. I mean, movies aren't something that you can just have a group like come together once every few years and put something on in a theater. You need a pretty major infrastructure to support anything more than art films. So don't be so sure about that. They'll never die thing.
I'm not sure, and I'll have to pivot. I mean, if they do, there certainly is nothing I can do about it. But I just think it's a bizarre phenomenon to see something that just felt like so permanent in our culture, probably center in our culture, become something that is getting close to being like going to the opera. You know, it's on the verge in some cases.
You know, just like about 15 years ago, in every city in America, they used to like print this thing that had these like miniature, I don't know what you would call them. They called them articles at the time, sort of accounts of things that happened in the world. Plus they had like cartoons in them and puzzles, and you could find out the weather, and they printed that.
Oh, you mean newspapers?
Yeah, and they would deliver them to every single house in the entire city, and everybody would sit down and read that every morning. Yeah. And that just like 15 years ago, they did that.
Okay. But that's still not the movies. You know, it's like, yeah, people now read their news digitally. I guess they watch. I guess they watch their entertainment digitally as well. So let's talk about. All right. So I hear you. I'm not trying to be a fogey. I just enjoy the experience of going to the movies. I like the big rooms. I like the big sound. I like the popcorn. I like all that stuff. It's so central to our culture.
I'm a big fan of tableau vivants. Do you remember those when people would create like what you'd have like human recreations of sort of paintings or scenes from history, and you could walk around and watch them?
Or men with fake mustaches riding unicycles would ride across the stage juggling dogs. Yes,
those are phenomenal.
Large breasted women would belt out blues standards, you know, and in a speakeasy. Yeah, I know. I get it. I'm old. I get it. Don't remind me, Richard, but I still like the movies. All right. So let's pivot because we do some specific content talk on this show as well.
Yeah.
And I know that you're within the best of your abilities, a great consumer of various forms of media.
I love content.
Yeah. You are a great consumer of content. So we've enough with the films. We talk about films all the time on the show. Right. Let's talk about books a little bit, and then a little bit about streaming TV. What have you been consuming in terms of the printed word of late?
Well, in books, I'm actually reading a book. I'm enjoying enormously. I'm almost done with it. I'm going to finish it tonight. More than I thought. Moss Hart's autobiography. Have you ever read that?
Oh, Act One.
Yeah.
Yeah, I've read that a couple of times.
Something people have told me to read for 40 years, and finally came down off my shelf. And I don't know if I've ever read a better account of creating a work of performance.
Yeah. So Moss Hart was a playwright in the 20s and 30s and 40s. You say that was his era? Basically,
he's talking about his breakthrough, which happened in 1930. So,
which was it? Can't take it with you. Can't take it with you, right? He wrote that.
No,
wrote that
with was that the adaptation of it?
I don't know. He co-wrote this thing with George S. Kaufman, the legendary playwright, contributor to the Marx Brothers, and Moss Hart is this kind of like gee whiz kid from
Once
from
in a Brooklyn. Lifetime. That's the name of the play.
Yeah. Oh, Once in a Lifetime. Yeah. 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 That is a great book, and it's on my shelf now. And they did an adaptation of that on Broadway about 10 years ago. That was quite bad. I went to see that, but yeah, that is. A great book, highly recommended. But you're not reading anything published in the last 100 years, I take it.
I read a lot of mysteries these days. Now. Uh-huh. I do a lot of mysteries and thrillers.
I read
this year Tana French's new edition of her Dublin Murder Squad, which was printed this year, so it's contemporary, hot off the presses. I read it, and
we've covered her as well.
For
some reason, I actually like in terms of genre, like I contemporary genre. I read a lot of science fiction, I write science fiction. I don't know if you were. I mean, I know no one's aware of that because
I read it when I was young, but
I still do. But because I run this website, I try to delve into literary fiction because there's always like fun gossip about literary fiction because it's the kind of thing that gets a lot of headlines, but that no one reads. I read this book called Burnham Wood by Eleanor Catton.
Yes, I read that.
You read that too. Eleanor Catton. She's a New Zealand writer. And that the ending was extremely depressing.
The ending was the most amazing.
But incredible.
We
shouldn't give it away.
Can we give it away?
It's basically like an eco thriller set in New Zealand that also is about billionaires and drones. But unlike a lot of like these sort of modern books that like try to present these contemporary dystopias that are the end of the world. This was not a book about the end of the world. It was what I liked about it was that it was very much grounded in reality, and the characters had a lot of depth and nuance. And I thought that
the environmentalists are like right on the edge of like legitimately
insane.
Concerned and doing it and totally unhinged.
Yeah, and these unhinged, basically modern hippies. And she did a great job getting in the head of this billionaire. He was both a sociopath and also completely right about everything. I think that's a great book. Her first book was called The Luminaries, or her second book. I haven't read that. It won the Booker Prize in 2013.
Have you read this year's Booker winner? I have that on my
What is this year's Booker winner?
Kairos by Jenny Erpenbeck.
Okay. I have not read Kairos by Jenny Erpenbeck. That doesn't sound like a real person. Among contemporary literature, I would say Burnham Wood. I recommend that very highly. I've also been kind of poking around in the new Zadie Smith novel, The Fraud, which we have not really talked about on this show before. Zadie Smith is someone who was a contemporary of mine because I came up through McSweeney's and she was kind of around and we knew each other back in the day. And I felt like her books like kind of started delving into like almost like experimental fiction territory. But this is a book more like it's almost like a satire of like a fake Charles Dickens from Victorian England. And it's actually quite witty and subtle and funny. And I recommend it. It's got a good sense of humor, great characters, very well written, short chapters, so it's easy to like poke into for 20 minutes before you go to sleep. I recommend that the Fraud by Zadie Smith as well. So
I'll consider it.
I think you'd like it. I think you'd like it. Any book that talks shit about writers,
yeah, that's a good element.
Because all we do when we're on our text threads, various text threads that we're involved in, all we do is talk shit about other writers. Because what else are you going to do if you're a writer? All right, but let's pivot. I do know that you watch a lot of television.
I watch the average American watches 6 to 8 hours a day. I watch far less than that. So I don't.
Okay, you watch when you do watch television. You're engaged in your television. So what have you been watching of late?
I'm currently watching one show and hate watching another show.
All right.
What are you watching? I'm watching Franklin, starring Michael Douglas
as Benjamin Franklin.
Paris, trying to save.
Not hate watching that.
No, I'm enjoying it actually quite a bit. It's
Is it as good as George Washington starring Barry Bostwick?
Nothing can compete with North and South starring Kirstie Alley, uh-huh. It's very good. It's Beaumarchais is in it, and a lively character. And a very different Louis the 16th than you've seen before. So
okay, all right.
It's Michael Douglas he is Benjamin Franklin. I feel it. It's
no one's ever said he wasn't a pro. All right. So where do you hate watching?
I am hate watching Hacks on HBO.
Interesting. Because all I see, that's interesting that you say that. Because all I see on my feed is Hacks is amazing. I love Hacks. I love it. Oh my gosh, it's so wonderful. It's so incredible.
Operating with different definitions of wonderful and amazing.
What is it about Hacks that really that really grinds your gears?
So there's two things about Hacks that are really great that make me keep doing it. Like Jean Smart playing Joan Rivers basically is terrific, and that it's set in Las Vegas is great. Everything else about it, especially her co-star, are very hard to watch and amateurish and difficult to see.
Do you find it smug and insidery?
It's kind of like smug and insidery by someone who doesn't really know what insiders are going. So someone making a smug parody of insider life that doesn't actually approximate the reality. There's a multitude of characters that aren't remotely funny is a problem.
Yeah, that would be a problem. It's okay.
I find it difficult.
Don't have a heart attack.
But here I am in season three.
Yeah.
And I'm still
watching it.
I'm still with it. I'm gonna be with them in season four, I'm sure.
This happens with a lot of HBO style shows though. You're just with them to the bitter end, whether they're good or not. All right. So first of all, it's summer. So my TV diet is there's a lot of baseball. As you know that I'm cursed with watching baseball, but also like I watch a lot of food television. So I'm constantly watching chefs getting eliminated from various.
In Japan, half of TV is food television.
Yeah. It's like, is that right? That sounds about
right. Half of the shows on TV in Japan are food.
I mean, I feel like half of what I feel like all I do is I eat two or three meals a day. And I and then some snacks, and usually that's a good time to watch chefs getting eliminated. So there's not and a lot of I find like I'm watching a lot of like two or three or four episodes of shows, and then kind of falling asleep while I'm watching them. And it's not because I'm old and tired, because I do stay up late playing poker most nights. So it's not like I can't stay awake. The one fictional show that I and we have talked about this briefly that I cannot get enough of, and there's not currently a new season running, is the show on Apple TV called For All Mankind, which is a fictional alternate. I'm not quite finished, but I only have two episodes to go of the current four season run. I'm almost there.
So you're two episodes away from the series.
Don't tell
finale?
Me from this. From no, it's not a series finale because they're making a fifth season.
But it's kind of a spinoff that's not...
No, they're doing a spinoff set in Russia. It's called Star City. But they're also doing... they're planning seven seasons of this thing.
Oh, Fuji,
They're planning seven seasons.
I should
read the trades. It's not a series. That's the plan. They haven't canceled it.
For All Mankind is on my top five of streaming era shows.
I love this show so much, and my wife makes fun of it. She's like, she's like a little kid saying, what's going to happen to the astronauts next? And that's exactly right. It's like, it's an alternate history astronaut soap opera.
The season one and season two finales were, I think, the most exciting, gripping hours of television I ever watched. Well,
it's a great show because it's like, I mean, not everything works. You know, there's some cheesy writing. There's some corny soap opera plot twists, right? The acting is not uniformly great. I don't consider Joel Kinnaman to be like any kind of a genius.
He brings that character to
That character is like, his character, grumpy. He's kind of like if Chuck Yeager had lived to go to Mars, essentially. is Admiral Ed Baldwin
and how he comes to have bonds with other people and becomes a pothead in the season you're watching now.
Yeah, that's very interesting. You know, and it goes from being like basically the premise of the show is that the Soviets land on the moon first. About 10 days before Neil Armstrong and Buzz Aldrin do it, essentially, or something like that. There's not a long, but they land on the moon first, and this it spins off an entirely different timeline where people colonize the moon starting in the early 70s, thanks to the goodwill of Richard Nixon. And then they end up colonizing Mars by the 90s. And there's different presidents. You know, it goes goes Richard Nixon, Ted Kennedy, Ronald Reagan.
It's brilliant that they do these montages as you speed up at the beginning of every series, like to combine real life facts with their fake president being elected. And
there's one fake president. And then there's a bunch of real presidents just out of timeline. And Al Gore becomes president. The Clintons get divorced. John Lennon is alive. his assassination is thwarted. The Beatles reunite. He plays the Super Bowl halftime show. They don't show that. Most of the show takes place like at NASA or like in these companies. But it's just such a great show, you know. And I love there's the Gordo and Tracy Stevens. You know, those characters are just
couple. They were terrific. And then their children go on to destroy it, to ruin the world.
They're complete psychotic weirdos. So it's like, it's just a great show. And the science but is
it,
great.
It was all kicked off because before the events of the first film, Joel Kinnaman's character had orbited the moon and could have landed.
Yes.
But got cold feet at the last second. So yes. If he had gone through with it, he would have been the first man on the moon and none of this would have happened.
Well, it still would have been an alternate history, but it would have been a U.S. dominated alternate history. And there's just a lot of like the U.S. Soviet tensions are there, but they're different. I want to see them go forward. It's kind of like it's like the first germ of Star Trek in a lot of ways, or The Expanse, shows that take place much further in the future and much further in a sci-fi reality. This is like recent past and present day. I love this show.
I'm with you.
It's kind of like Mad Men in space. It's like Mad Men. It's like if Mad Men were in space.
Now, did you watch underappreciated? But did you watch Masters of Air?
I have not yet. I'm finishing all four seasons. These are both Apple TV Plus. Basically, what happens is my son got a new phone, and Apple TV Plus was activated, and I immediately started watching For All Mankind. And I find myself, watching it at two, sitting around watching it at 2 a.m. I love it so much. Masters of Air, not yet. That is, I love Band of Brothers and also the Pacific Band of Brothers.
I think you'll be happy with Masters of Air.
I'm a middle-aged man who's always been interested in World War II content. I know Apple, that Masters of Air.
Apple TV seems to really figured out how to manipulate our demographic here.
Well, it's just dad. We're just dads, and it's dad content. Just a couple of grumpy dads who want to go to the movies. My guest this week has been Richard Rushfield, who is a columnist and a founding light of The Ankler, which is a weekly newsletter, or a daily in some ways. It's an online newsletter about the movie industry. Richard, if people want to subscribe to The Ankler, how do they do that?
You can go to theankler.com and sign up for previews and occasional free articles there and be kept abreast of everything that happens.
Unlike The Ankler, Book and Film Globe is always free, and we publish fresh articles nearly every day at www.bookandfilmglobe.com. We cover the worlds of books and film and streaming TV. We even did a couple articles about YouTube last week. That's how hip we are. And this podcast comes out most weeks, hosted by me, Neil Pollack, the editor-in-chief of Book and Film Globe, and the greatest living American writer until someone can usurp that title from me. And they're not going to until I die, Richard, 35 years from now. So I'm going to hold it for basically another lifetime. So thank you so much, Richard Rushfield, for visiting me in the podcast den this week. And thank you all for listening. I will talk to you soon.
Original production.